thinking they're monsters. No real ones, but there are.
Yes, there are.
Welcome. This is the Collective Nightmares podcast. We are sociologists who talk horror films. My name is Marshall Smith. Our podcast is built around the idea from Robin Wood's critical essay about a sociological understanding of horror films that where Wood argued that the horror films of a society can be read in a similar way that dreams or nightmares can be read to reveal something about the fears and anxieties and the political cultural moment in which those horror films appear. And we use that as a starting point to launch into a discussion of one particular film each week for analysis.
I'm Laura Patterson. Marshall and I both have our PhDs in sociology from the University of Colorado. And yeah, it's amazing how much fodder a horror film, even a McDonaldized third version of a popular horror film, can create for this kind of conversation. So, I mean, there's definitely something to that argument because there's a lot of philosophical wanderings that can be done on this kind of text.
Fabulous. Yes. And so we kind of got ourselves in the weeds here, but this episode is about The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, which is The Conjuring 3. Spoilers in this episode. We spoil the film. We dive right into in-depth discussion. We encourage you to, or at least want to give you the opportunity to be sure and see the film before we spoil it, especially with horror films. You only get that one chance to really experience it and be scared in certain ways. So we encourage that. We also definitely spoil the heck out of Conjuring 2.
And even more so than spoiling it, really, because I don't know how many spoilers we gave away, but we discuss it in a lot of depth in the second half of this podcast. So it might be worth your time if you're so inclined to watch Conjuring 2 and really listen to our Conjuring 2 podcast and have a sense of what we're talking about when we dig into the second half of the podcast.
Yeah, we try and present the episodes usually as more or less standalone episodes, even though our conversation is an ongoing, evolving conversation. This one in particular, Laura, I think you're absolutely right to have seen the second film for sure, and ideally maybe have listened to some of our episode on The Conjuring 2 before digging into this one. So we spoil those two Conjuring films. I don't think we really spoil the first one, and I don't think we really spoil anything else. Okay, nice. Hold my purse, Laura. We're going to have a discussion.
All right, so Conjuring 3.
Ohio, yeah, keeping it classy. All right, let's do
The Conjuringer.
All right.
I was so tempted to cancel like 5 times today while I was trying to move all this stuff over, and I was like, no, I can do it. And I did it. It was okay.
All right, I'm sorry. Thanks for letting me stall there. I got subtitles this time. I still don't know why I couldn't find them for Conjuring 2.
Three.
I know this is 3, but I couldn't find them for 2.
Oh,
I never found subtitles for 2. Just never did. And I got the film here queued up in case we actually need to reference it this time. So all that being said, all right, Conjuring 3. It was quite a ride here, Laura. Wait, do you want to grade 2 first, or were you going to do that at the end?
I think I can do that as part of 3. I think that'll be perfectly fine.
Oh, okay, good. Okay.
I'm curious to hear your take first. I think you should lead this one.
Really? Oh my. Well, that's very interesting. All right, so I can do this. This is not as skillful. This film is not as skillfully made as Wan's films are. And it is all the more interesting to me how it's just a wonderful example of the je ne sais quoi of why some directors are able to make a film that has a signature style and feel and tone, and it comes together to be more than the sum of its parts. For me, this is a film that is precisely the sum of its parts. It never transcends to be some sort of film that is scary or have some sort of just feeling of being beyond a typical film. And so there's that. I mean, it was all put together fine. It just didn't have whatever it is that has made James Wan's films, for the most part, whatever they are. I mean, it's got all the pieces. It's got all the pieces, but it just doesn't ever, I didn't ever get to it. And maybe that's part of that set being a third, but it I don't think it is. I don't think it is just being the trilogy. And then on the more of our level of discussion or analysis or whatever, I think this is a pristine example of folks who have heard criticisms of their film being sexist and racist, and I guess that's mostly it, and tried to make it better, but actually all they did was demonstrate how much worse their film is. It's the classic. It's a perfect example of what I imagine diversity in the 80s used to be. Like, we're just going to bolt on what I've always heard. We've talked about this on this podcast before, like bolt on diversity. Like, we're not going to fundamentally change how we approach adding elements to our film. What we're going to do is we're going to take our racist, sexist film and we're going to sprinkle in a little something here and there to try and make it less so, but it doesn't actually work. All it is is like, I can't think of a great metaphor right now, but it's all you're doing is adding spices to the stew that don't actually change the overall dish. That's a terrible metaphor, but I can't think of what else to say. So that's my piece overall.
Yeah, I felt like this was just more of the same, really, but more of the same in a way that wasn't terribly interesting. I mean, The Conjuring 1, at least, when we talked about it, I felt like I learned some interesting things about the world, and I observed some things that were just, I don't know, helped, I guess, build my own knowledge base and opinions around these types of films, like around possession films, and helped me see the way that stereotypes were presented, I don't know, through a lens that in some ways I hadn't noticed before. And I thought The Conjuring 1, at least our conversation about The Conjuring 1, was really eye-opening for me. And The Conjuring 2, less so, but it did still, the part where I got hung up on grading it actually did still lead to some thoughts that I want to finish in this episode. So that started like one ball rolling. This one, it didn't do anything for me. It didn't raise any new questions. It didn't really address anything in ways that are very different from what have come up in the past. And, you know, maybe that's because we're dealing with a McDonaldized third. And this is a franchise that, you know, how well did this one do? I'm curious, particularly in light of what you said about the previous films just being more skillfully done, which I would agree with. Does anyone care? Or is it still just,
I mean, it's so really hard well? To say, because this was released, I'm sorry, I'm looking. I mean, it's, why doesn't, God damn it. IMDb, it's just so sad to see it decline from it being what it was, which was a usable, functional website. I don't have a budget, but the box office for US and Canada, 62 million worldwide, 174. So it's, I mean, post COVID, so far as I know, that's great. It's doing great. Let me see if I can find a budget. I was going to say it's weird because it came out streaming and in theaters at the same time, or maybe like a week after. It was only in theaters for like a week, maybe two, before they released it streaming. So given that, I think those numbers in particular are good. I think are really good. So yes, people still care, I guess. Yeah.
And so it felt like a formula.
Oh yeah.
And I guess it is. And I guess it's a formula that makes money. And I mean, still very much like the second film. I thought the second was a break from the first in that the second to me felt so religiously focused. And the back, like the story behind that was really minimal. It just felt like it was about religion. It was kind of an anthem about Christianity to me. And the third now, I think, felt the same way. I had a very similar reaction that I did to the second. But that's, I mean, I guess I can still find some things to talk about in there. But I'm curious to ask you, did you learn anything? And I mean, I don't mean from the film necessarily, or even just your own thoughts about the film. Did you learn anything in this film that's new from the second film? Like, did this do anything else to the conversation for you?
Well, I'm sort of surprised that you're, I'm just surprised. I mean, I know we're doing this at late at night for you. And you've had a long day, but you know, our conversation for Conjuring 2, you came in like guns blazing and you seem very even keeled as to your, and I don't know if that's your, just your affect more than how you're actually thinking about it or what's happening there, but, or maybe it is like you're saying, because at least with 2, it felt new. And so you, it was easier to have a stronger reaction. What did you ask me? I'm just rambling.
Well, so two things. Sorry. Let me respond to what you just said, which is, I think that when we talk about grading 2 and kind of getting into that question, I think that will answer some of what you're reading off me emotionally. But why I asked you is, did you learn anything new in this third one?
Well, here's what I mean, here's big piece I got, or big pieces I got from 3 that, and maybe you, I think we did this reverse last time, and maybe you can pick if we want to, which of these we want to dig through or what. The bolt-on diversity here was we actually had folks of color, but they were all in supporting secondary roles. So not even like supporting role, but a step removed, but they were there. Okay. Whatever. Still, that's, I mean, it's almost, like I said, it's almost worse. It's like, if they made this film 40 years ago, that sort of approach would have been like, oh yeah, good for them. They gave some works folks of color, but it's 2020 fucking one. And then it was absolutely, for me this time, I guess because I was finally looking for it, was absolutely like, yes, Jesus saves, right? and as we saw in the second one, it became this vigilante Jesus saves of, we're not even going to listen to the church. We now have to take our own religious authority into, we have to rely on it because the church is not Christian enough. Like the Catholic Church, like the Pope and the infrastructure, the bureaucracy of the church is not effective enough for us. So, you know,
church, it's ridiculous how much the church lets them down with their exorcisms. Like I was actually laughing in that first scene, like, oh my gosh, again with the paperwork, like the church just can't get their, you know, they just can't get it together fast enough.
Yeah. So this is even more of that, right? And so then we also talked about how, let me think, you'll have to help me fill this in. We talked about in the first one, how they made a very specific presentation where the religious experience and religious expertise was vindicated as superior to empirical research, particularly as connected to academic institutions. So the university failed, and where the university fails, or this, the discourse of science fails, the Warrens they're the ones who got it figured out. And then in the second one, it was, what was the other? Was it just the church fails? The bureaucracy of the church fails? So they have to go beyond. Oh, and the media also fails because they have the news crew. And then there's a little bit of the academic, but it's really the media has failed to support the religious things that are happening and actually be able to address it because it comes to scandal and everything. And so in this one, it's the legal system and law enforcement that are unable to. So that I think was new. So it's, if you took like each of the Conjuring films is like chipping away at the fundamental institutions of a liberal democratic society, like post French Revolution.
I love how you're doing this, Marshall. I love it.
This is genius. This is, oh God, look, the legal system should really be, I mean, let's face it, all of you neo-evangelicals out in America, the legal system really should be acknowledging real Christianity, which is what the Supreme Court has doing literally like a week ago. Like they couldn't have timed it. It's actually astounding that they wrote this and then this, and I guess, well, they Barrett's been on the court. So it's like Barrett got on the court and somebody was like, great, let's write about how Jesus should be even more in the legal system in the United States. And Barrett's like, you know, Barrett's at home watching this like, oh yeah, this is great. Like, how can I, her and Kavanaugh are sitting around having beers, hoping that somebody will use the devil made me do it defense so that they can sign off on it finally. Preferably some way that also demonizes abortion. But okay, so that's really what I thought was most astounding about this film. And I guess would be the big new idea was here's where the other failures were, if we want to say broadly speaking, university empiricism, media, bureaucracy of the church, this is legal system, criminal justice system writ large, here's how it has failed. And then this somehow, something I'm really curious to hear you about is I took this film as like totally transphobic. I thought it looked to me, and this is where I would really love a check on me if I'm mapping that onto the film or if it was there. I felt like they cast the witch daughter, whoever, to be someone who looked not only not traditionally feminine, in stark contrast to the hyper femininity of Lorraine Warren and her daughter, who were wearing like Victorian blouses for no apparent reason throughout like the whole film. And they cast the witch doctor to not only be not traditionally feminine in appearance, which I think was exaggerated through like lighting and makeup, but also to look somehow very similar to Arnie. So that person was really, really there. They were marked as the evildoer by being the only person in really the whole film to not adhere to very strong gender roles. Didn't meet the hegemonic expectations of appearance for gendered bodies. Those are my big things, I think.
I love what you're saying there. Now that you say that, I think you're exactly right. And honestly, I didn't catch it. What I caught was that she was older. I honed in on how they showed her age and how she was not attractive. And okay, that the other women were presented, but you're right. I mean, I think I'm reading the same thing in a slightly different way because she kept getting older looking as she got more evil. And like the wrinkles in her neck and things just got worse looking as she progressed into more evil. And so I was taking that on like a, I don't know, an aging sort of attractiveness note. In contrast, like you said, to the fact that the women were sort of hyper-feminized in this film. I mean, Lorraine always is really, but it bothered me more in this film. And maybe it's just because I'm getting a little bit Conjuringed out. So I was like not having it with Lorraine's outfit. I was like, oh, come on. You know? And when Ed tells her, you know, don't go into that cave or whatever, because you'll get your dress all dirty. And I'm just like, I can't handle you. And Lorraine, I just can't handle you anymore.
Okay. So hold on. Let's talk about that scene because I noticed that too. And what was more egregious to me was not that Ed said that, which is a classic Ed. That's exactly what he should have said. It's that daughter and Lorraine looked at each other like, oh, this silly man who would just assume that we can't do anything for ourselves. We'll show. I mean, that's, and it's like, you're being dismissive of his comment when that's exactly how we've watched you interact and been totally useless for 5 hours of film. And now all of a sudden you're going to roll your eyes because he's worried about your dirty dress. That's exactly that's a pristine example of, hold on, of how this film was just overall here. This right here. Look at this look.
Look at this look. All I see is the tunnel.
Oh, God dang it. Hold on. Share screen. Oh, here. Optimize for video. There, I've got it now. Look at them looking at each other like, oh, silly man. Oh, my goodness. Oh, this is so absurd. Oh, my God. That was what it was about that scene. I was like, oh, my God. You've shot 6 solid hours of Conjuring film and somebody was like, oh, that seems too sexist. Why don't we have the girls roll their eyes about that? And then I just, oh my God.
It feels like the Bolton diversity, like you're talking about. And again, like if this had been filmed, you know, 80 years ago, it would have a little more impact.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so as long as I'm doing this, so here is, because I really do want to check on me. Oh, shoot. So this is
Ida.
Ida is her?
Yeah, I think Ida, yeah.
I don't think I ever got that. I mean, this to me, the way that they are presented is, I mean, her hair is, these are not the feminine features that seem to be true of everyone else. There's, and it's not just the no makeup. And when I look at this, and then there's another great shot. I should be screen capturing these. You're right, old, definitely old. See, I feel like they were cast to look similar to Arnie. I know that lighting is totally different, but I swear they were meant to be. Just there was meant to be visual cue was this person is not presenting gender appropriately. And that's how we know that they're scary. Like in Disney, like, oh, well, if that person is dark skinned, we know that they're evil. Right. Anyway, I got that. I just wanted to throw that out. That's not, go ahead. Sorry.
I think what you're saying is really important. And I think, you know, often I say there's like a bad box or a bad bucket and we're throwing different traits into it. I think what you picked up on there is subtle, but I think it's right on. And I think it's important to just, again, highlight that concept of like, what traits do the bad people get to tell us they're bad? And I don't know. I think there's a good case to be made for androgyny being in that box in this film. I also think age could be in that box in this film. And, you know, ageism in horror is something that we haven't really delved into much at all. And I would like to. I know I mentioned a film a while ago that I thought might touch on that. So I think that could be an interesting direction for us to take in the future in this podcast, is to try to seek out some things that deal with age, because I do think that age often can fall in the bad basket as well, at least for women. Because when they're young, they're sexy. And when they're sexy, well, I guess it's a different thing, right? Women are portrayed as evil, sexy, sometimes. We'd have to dig through that. There's stuff there, and I would like to get into it. We've never really gotten into that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's. I think we've acknowledged that, and the relegation of the few folks of color to the secondary bits. Oh, and then I'd noticed there was one other thing that I noticed, which. I guess I could throw on there that's maybe a lesser thing too, was I felt like there was a lot of vaginal imagery or yonic imagery for evil stuff. There was that basement. It's like crawling down into the hole. There was what made me think of it was my former roommate who but would call, because we have a cast iron tub that has shower curtains around three sides. He would call it the big plastic vagina, because when you get in and the hot water comes in, it pulls in all the through whatever dynamic that is. And so when Arnie is in the tub and they have the shot over it with the blood, I was like, oh, well, so it's, of course it's horrible. He's in a big bloody vagina. And then the weird, like, gooey hole in the wall that he like is. So there's all these like dark, scary holes. Which is not what I'm just, which is not what
you're
I'm
just seeing vaginas everywhere.
Am I?
you know what's funny is that like this is like the fifth film where you've been like, there are vaginas here. And then whenever you show me, you're totally right. Like, was that Revenge with the foot vagina?
Oh,
I had no idea
vaginas.
What you were talking about, and it was clearly there.
The foot vaginas, there that I would defend to my grave. That's absolutely. Oh, okay.
It was also teeth where you were pulling out all the vaginas and you were right. So I'm tempted to say you just have a really good eye for finding vaginas. I missed all of the vaginas in this. Oh my gosh.
I'm not saying this is what I think. I think that the filmmakers are using this sort of imagery because they think it's got issues.
Let's see. Put it in the bad box, Marshall. You're right.
What else? There was something else, though. There was something else. Something else. Here's courthouse. Oh, here. Oh, yeah. Look, this is. This is a reach. The waterbed as like. I don't know what's going on with the waterbed.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to give you that one of the images you've pulled up here.
That's fair. And I don't know about that. That's not either. But like. We just looked at this. That's more of a reach. I understand, but still, it's like crawling back in down the basement. There was one other. There was the, I don't know where the shower with Arnie was. Was that right in the beginning?
It was real close to the beginning, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There we go. I mean, this is very birth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Poltergeisty bathtub birthy.
I think there's something there. And again, I'll just say that I think what makes the bad box interesting is that it's subtle and it's not on purpose often. And I think when you highlight things like that, like this idea that we as a culture have this sort of background idea. I mean, obviously not everyone, right? But the idea exists out there that vaginal imagery is scary.
Right, right.
I think that I think you make a really good case.
Okay. So there's that. Those are my things. Like you said, it was, I think for me, I got excited about this because I didn't have the experience you had during Conjuring 2 because I don't know what was going on with me. I did kind of, but I just didn't piece it together. And so when you came in, were telling me this. And then this thing, I guess the other interesting difference here is this film, they totally fooled in the heterosexual imaginary.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Oh my gosh.
Whereas in part two, you know, it was the woman whose husband had cheated on her and left. And so the heterosexuality was saving them because Ed and Lorraine come in and Ed could be father figure. But it wasn't like this was at a whole nother level of to the point where I was like, when and where? What is the fucking thing with gazebos? And like, Where did that come from? Where did that start? Why are gazebos and like white rural heterosexuality? Why are those two things so intertwined? Where did that? Where is that from? Did that start somewhere? Is that in some play or some iconic movie or what the fuck is it? Because I started thinking about like that's totally this. Bizarrely iconic, even for me. I was like, I don't even know why I have this idea, but I see a gazebo in like a small town center area, preferably after like a, well, this is a movie, but or a state fair. And and that's basically your like MAGA romance narrative of the 50s, right? Like you've got two hegemonic, you know, white, able-bodied, educated, clean, gender performant, gender normative people, and a movie or a state fair and a gazebo, and that's it. That's your married life, right? That's like your good traditional value hetero relationship, childhood or high school sweetheart story. And they like leaned on that. We got the like sepia toned flashbacks. We've got love at first sight. And then it's fully like all the way to kind of hate to use the reference because of the filmmakers involved, but all the way to like Mickey and Mallory Knox's like love beats the demon. Except in this case, literally. And father and daughter are evil because they have some, what happened there? Something that's not appropriate.
Wait, you're getting far off track here. First, I think for our audience, you should explain what the heterosexual imaginary is. And before you do that, I want to jump in and say that, you know, funny enough, my first kiss to a boy, because he was like 15, was in a gazebo.
Get the heck out of here!
It was absolutely in a gazebo. And so there are two possibilities, right? One is that we just somehow, this got into our brains also, and we enacted it without realizing it because this messaging is out there and you've somehow hit on something really important here. Or it was just convenient. You know, maybe there are gazebos in places where young couples are wandering around. And I don't know why my first kiss was in a gazebo, but it was. And in my memory, there was no like, I don't know, maybe we were drawn toward the gazebo. Maybe it was raining. Maybe it's weird to stop in the middle of a field. I don't know. But maybe that's happened to a lot of people and somehow this gazebo mythology has unfolded.
That's fair. There could actually be some utilitarian, like you said, there's some shelter. There's some sort of pseudo privacy to a certain extent.
I don't know.
That's
or
so
I just
amazing.
Bought into it without realizing it. I just find that very funny. But yeah, I think for our audience, you should explain what the heterosexual imaginary is before carrying on with your next train.
Sure. This was in Ohio that you had your gazebo kiss?
It was in Ohio, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes it even more fitting, right?
Right outside the place where I took my driver's lessons, my first driver's lessons, in a little like old downtown with a little square and a gazebo. It was probably white, but I don't remember.
Yeah. The heterosexual imaginary is Chris Ingraham's concept that a heterosexual romance is in and of itself reasoning, motivation, machine x do whatever it is, like the end all be all answer to every narrative as to motivation and resolution of the plot. It's why almost every major American film, if not every major media narrative, is built around some sort of heterosexual couple and heterosexual, primarily heterosexual couple. That has to be, everything has to be, every story has to include it. And it is, that relationship is, well, as this film perfectly illustrates, it is the linchpin of the narrative. It's the motivation, major motivating force throughout the film. It is how the film is resolved, whether or not it really actually needs to be in the film for plot. And sometimes I'm trying to think of what's a really classically bad shoehorned. I'll offer this as an explanation. Part of the reason it is so notable and so interesting that Mad Max Fury Road, Imperiosa, and Max do not have any sort of sexual romance, chemistry, any of that, is because of the heterosexual imaginary, because it is so unusual to see a film of any kind, of any substance in America, where you have a lead actor and actress, man and woman, who do not end up in having some sort of romantic heterosexual experience. They cannot just function as two people involved in a series of events without there being not just a sexual interaction, but a relationship built upon the institution of heterosexuality, which includes things like children and marriage and the other rituals and ceremonies around which U.S. culture privileges heterosexual couples. That was longer than it should have been, but that's okay.
And white gazebos.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And in this film, it was super notable because one wasn't enough. They had to really end by hammering it home with two of them. And we got that, the voiceover, but it wasn't a voiceover, the text over, I guess, at the end that told us that our couple, Arn and I don't remember his counterpart's name, but you know, that they got married 5 years into his prison sentence, or while he was in prison. And, they're still, I think it was a separate line. If I remember right, it was a separate line, and they're still married to this day. Like,
yes.
And I thought, all right, we got it. And then it's like, no, we need Ed and Lorraine. we gotta pull this back in and do it twice. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Which is notable. And I mean, that's something Glenda, my mentor from grad school, Glenda Walden, would emphasize with, if you're really performing the heterosexuality as an institution properly, you are not finished until you propagate the institution, which means that you have heterosexual kids of your own that then themselves have heterosexual kids. So until you make your parents grandparents, you have not completed the cycle for them. And so you aren't done until you become a grandparent yourself, because that ensures the propagation, the perpetuation of the heterosexuality as an institution. And so in this case, is this their kid?
Is who whose kid?
Is Debbie the Warren's kid? They're not. It's not, is it? Isn't the Warren's kid in it somewhere?
I didn't think she was in this one. She's in the locket. That's her picture.
Oh, she is the... Okay, so scratch what I was going to say. But it's important that it's important that Arn is not only saved from the demon, they have also repaired their heterosexual relationship. And I'm going to say that it is interesting that that the demon was initially summoned by the two girls out in the woods, because two girls shouldn't be out in the woods in some sort of way that could be possibly misconstrued as having feelings for each other. I know it's just a bracelet. It's supposed to be a friendship bracelet, but that's getting a little too gay in the world of The Conjuring, is it not?
I thought that too. And then I wondered exactly that. Like, am I just reading into this because I'm so over Conjuring land that I'm assuming things that they're actually not saying? I thought the exact same thing.
Well, I would say if you picked that up before we had talked through all of this, what is the May Festival? There's something there. You're seeing this? Oh, they're totally flirting. Oh, these terrible, terrible lesbian people. Isn't this like the Braveheart wedding, or like before Zales, or before De Beers monopolized and colonized the diamond industry and roped in a mythology of diamonds as connected to the heterosexuality in the form of a wedding ring? This is how weddings were done, as you wrapped up your hands together with, like, am I just spinning
here? I don't know.
Oh, I'm going to run with this. I would like to know how much post-production work was done, particularly with Lorraine's eyes, to get the cast light. Oh, this is totally queer. because she's stabbing her with her little her knife, which, as we all know, is, oh, look at that, she's penetrating her. Oh my god, this is totally the a homoerotic through violence sexualized experience. Oh my goodness. Okay, so this is totally a homophobic and transphobic film. Oh yeah, I'm all over that. So that was how the demon got in there. Is there was definitely shouldn't leave two women alone in the woods. That's supposed to be, you know, that's just not right in the heterosexual world. And look what happens. Look what happens. You get demons. You get a enterprising or a beginning marriage mixed up. Oh, and look at this. And also, oh, I'm just running with this now, Laura. Feel free to interject. What summons the demon out of Arn is that the landlord decides to dance a little bit with his girlfriend, which was creepy and totally unacceptable because she had said no, she didn't want to. But that was not why Arn was upset. Arn was upset not because she had refused, but because she, as his girlfriend, means that a man is intruding on his property in very classic misogynistic patriarchal form. So he grabs his woman, quote unquote, to dance with at their picnic or whatever. And that is enough for the demon to be, the demon is apparently summoned by intrusions on heterosexual relationships or the institution of heterosexuality. And what we ended up with for the whole film, the premise of the whole film is, yeah, Arn should have been. It really wasn't that bad that he killed this guy. I mean, the devil made him do it. It's like the gay panic defense. You know, oh, well, I can't be held responsible if I retaliate and murder some poor queer person if I thought they were gay. I mean, that's clearly reason enough to panic and feel threatened for my life such that I have cause to injure or somehow wound them.
Okay, I feel like your last point is a bit of a reach, but I mean, well, tying that to the film, I think is a bit of a reach.
No, it's just in the same kind of idea of somehow if it's a threat, I was going to say like this right here is, oh, look, he's intruding. Oh no. Oh my God. What is happening here? A woman is touching another man. My woman is touching another man. You're right. The gay panic defense is not in the film. I was just using that to say that within that neoconservative evangelical Christian ideology that this film is built on otherwise, any sort of fundamental intrusion or any, not even fundamental, but perceived threat to the institution of heterosexuality needs to be reacted to with extraordinary, sometimes lethal force. It must be protected as though our lives depend on it. That's what I was saying. You're right. There is no, that's not, I don't think, in this film. No.
I love all of the subtleties that you're picking up on. And I'm embarrassed to say that I was looking in a lot of the wrong places. I missed a lot of these. And what I was looking for was who was denoted as evil and what the evil was. And I found that question to be pretty empty. And I liked that it was empty. I mean, in the world of this film where I feel like we're just walking around in a minefield of problematic stuff, I liked that they were Satanists. That's what they were called. And I was trying to figure out who are the Satanists, like what, you know, what characteristics are these Satanists going to hold?
Yeah,
because that's going to tell us like what evil is in this film. And they weren't given any characteristics. Like they were empty. They were discussed as the Satanists. Oh, they're evil. Oh, they worship Satan. They were just bad, but they really didn't have anything hanging on them to be bad. I think you're right. I think the androgyny piece is, I think there's something there. I picked up on the old or the sort of aging piece as something, but I felt like I was grasping at straws, really. I was glad, I guess, that it was a white woman because that, well, because the whole
thing. Oh, I see what you're saying. I'm sorry. I see what you're saying. Go ahead. Please explain. It just took me a second.
We were living basically in a white world. Like you said, there in this film, there was more diversity than there had been previously, but still it was essentially a white world. And I was glad that our Satanists, when we finally, I was afraid when we met them that they were going to have some sort of traits where it's like, oh, this is, you know, this is going to be really problematic what they decided to put in the bad box, but they didn't, except for I saw age and you saw androgyny. And I think that's there, but at least it was, yeah, it was a white woman. We got basically no backstory that implicated her in any way that was troubling, like the first Conjuring, right? In the first Conjuring, it was women who were bad mothers who were targeted. But here, you know, we had what the dad raised her to, he was interested in the occult and she somehow picked up his interest and, you know, be careful what you teach to your kids. Like it was vapid. There was no backstory on who evil was. And so I was looking at this film and thinking, it really is just like the second one, an anthem for Christianity, an anthem for believing, you know, for anti-empiricism, for believing that all of this is true in spite of all these institutions and naysayers who want to tell you that it's not true, but that what they characterized as bad, I saw as basically an empty basket. For the most part. And I think all these subtleties that you're picking up are really important because they're there, and maybe even more so important because they're subtle enough that they weren't harped on in the film. You know, it's not like previous films where we see the nuclear family break up and the evil intrudes at that moment. And we can just, I don't know, that it wasn't as obvious, I guess, in this film, but I think you're making a good point for some, you're making a good case for there being subtle sexuality messages that all do probably tie together to be something a bit larger.
As opposed to the not subtle pro-Christian messages.
Correct.
All right, I got one more piece of this puzzle to add before we move on. Let's see, at least in the US, the Maypole dance, I knew this was something. So the Maypole festivals in both England and then the early colonies of the United States were, I'm sorry, let me start that over. So the two girls who were possibly lesbicurious or more were, she got the bracelet, the one got the bracelet for their friend at the May Festival, which is the festival where there is a maypole, which is, and I knew there was something about a maypole dance that's in some nursery rhyme or something. And the earliest use of the maypole in America occurred in 1628, where the governor of New Plymouth wrote of an incident where a number of servants, together with the aid of an agent, broke free from their indentured servitude to create their own colony, setting up a maypole in the center of the settlement and behaving in such a way as to receive the scorn and disapproval of the nearby colonies. So basically, it was any association, the Maypole celebrations were seen as this debauchery that was unacceptable to the Protestant puritanical adherence of either England or the US. So it was people who were stepping outside of the rigid norms of sexuality in particular, and has been that history for 400 years. So for them to throw that in is either they knew what they were doing or they just got real, real lucky, but they had to know what they were doing. Nobody throws in, oh, hey, I got this festival at the May Festival. Nobody says that. That's not a thing. I've never in my life seen another reference to the May Festival or the Maypole in a film I could think of. The only reason I have any idea about that is my mom, there's some mention of it in Shakespeare that my mom somehow referenced in something she did as part of, she took her kids to the Shakespeare Festival and they had like a Maypole dance or something, which now is maybe a little strange, but whatever, which would also make sense, right? Shakespeare was this raunchy, lewd, at least in his era, he wasn't high art, right? He was lowbrow, all these sexual euphemisms and all these relationships that were inappropriate. So for him to have a May festival or a maypole in his story somewhere seems to be totally, totally normal. That's that piece. It's all coming together, Laura. All right. What else? What else do we got?
So I feel like this might be a good time to jump into rating the second slash leading into my take on the third. And I'm a little bit, I'm second guessing all of it, given all these pieces that you're pulling together, because I think a lot of them actually hold together fairly well. And so I will maybe, instead of making this a grand statement about the second and the third, I will just, I'll talk you through my thought process in trying to rate the second and how that impacted, I think, my viewing of the third one. I spent a lot of time, I mean, like a bizarre amount of time the day after we talked about the second, thinking about how to rate it. And what I was getting really hung up on was that I felt like the film basically was a message about Christianity, as we talked about. It had a lot of things in it that irritated me because that's not my culture. And it had bad gender messaging. I mean, the bad gender messaging was absolutely there. We also have seen many films that have probably that level of bad gender messaging. And that, when that's not the point of the film, because it wasn't really the point of the film, it was just kind of there throughout the film, isn't necessarily enough to like super, super, you know, rank it super low on the social responsibility scale. It's a certain ding against it because it's not good. But the main point of the film really wasn't about that. So I was having a hard time. I was having a hard time using that to justify completely failing it. And I thought I needed to take into account the fact that basically what the film was about was just like Jesus saves. Like you said, it's, you know, it was anti-empiricism. I don't like that either. I don't like that either. Anti-empiricism, Jesus saves. And that was it. There were Christmas trees all over the place. That was just what it was about. And I started thinking a lot the morning after our podcast, laying there in bed. And I was thinking about tolerance and how tolerance as a value implies discomfort. You know, you're not being tolerant of another culture if you already like it and if it already feels good to you. You're being tolerant if you say, okay, this doesn't feel good to me. I don't like it. It rubs me the wrong way. It creeps me out. I'm not enjoying this, but I have to, you know, I have to sort of let you be you to the extent that that doesn't infringe on somebody else's ability to be themselves. And so not liking it isn't enough to, I hope I'm not getting too, I hope this is linear enough that you're following this, but like when we're going to rank something on a scale of social responsibility, to me, that's a really important, weighty bar. And so that's not just, do I like it? Do I think it's contributing to culture in the way I want it to be? And do I look at, like, if I got to control the world, would I want people to like this film? No, I wouldn't, because it's not me and it's not my culture and it creeps me out and I don't like it. But I don't know if I'm willing to downgrade a film that was essentially just like, yay, Jesus, on a scale of social responsibility, if they're not actively transphobic or, you know, doing something with their messaging beyond just having lots of Christmas trees and all being white and doing their yay Jesus thing. Because I something was bothering me about downgrading it. Like I wanted to, and I felt like I couldn't. And I struck on that idea of tolerance. And I think that was the piece that was missing for me when we were having our conversation the night before. And that also felt very important in the context of a film about Christianity, because my main criticism of, you know, conservative Christian culture is lack of tolerance. And this idea that because, you know, I'm speaking in stereotypes here, but because the sort of conservative Christian movement doesn't like this group of people or that group of people or that group of people, it doesn't fit their perspective on how people should behave or whatever. They want to be able to limit their rights and they want to be able to take away other people's freedom so that they don't have to be made uncomfortable by someone else's culture. And I didn't like the fact that downgrading the film felt like doing that to some extent, because it wasn't overtly, I just couldn't pin it on, aside from the patriarchy stuff was obnoxious and that was bad. And I'm willing to call that socially irresponsible. I just don't know about like enough to completely give it an F. I mean, we let Tucker and Dale somewhat fly even with really problematic gender stuff. Like I had major issues with Seven and we struggled with that over how far down to downgrade it. You know, so I didn't feel like enough to take it all the way down to an F. And I thought I think I need to exhibit the same type of tolerance that I want conservative Christians to exhibit. And I need to say, you know what? It wasn't my film. I didn't like it. It made me uncomfortable. And I have to like float it at a C or something on that part, on the Christian part, because it was so, the messaging was so vapid. You know, to me, it was about, like I said, transphobia or something that I would, a type of aggression that I would pin on the conservative Christian movement. What it was really about was I was assuming a lot of those things. Like I was associating all of those bad things with conservative Christianity. And because this had so many triggers for conservative Christianity, that's what it was. I was implicating it, even though it wasn't really going beyond yay Jesus. And I didn't like, I thought that me doing that was hypocritical based on my critique of conservative Christianity. And so in some ways, I think that might explain the emotional reaction that you read off me going into this third film, because watching the third one, I had that thought already in my head. And I was trying to figure out again, what are they demonizing? Like, what is evil? And I missed everything that you laid out there. And I think it's great. And actually, you're making me question where I was sitting at the beginning of this conversation about this film. Or at least I think you're putting some more weight on the, okay, downgrade it more side of the scale, because I think some of that stuff was really there and I just didn't see it. But I was focusing so strongly on the Satanists because I was again looking for, can I justify this? Or am I just hating their outfits, just hating the way Lorraine acts, just hating the gender stuff's not cool. And it's just, I'm so over Ed and Lorraine. I'm so over them. Like, I just can't stand either one of them anymore. I can't stand the way they look at each other. I just can't stand it. I can't stand their happy little heterosexual imaginary. It drives me insane. I just cannot handle it. And everybody in this film and all the, oh God, there was so much that I could not stand, but I was trying to find what was really being demonized. And it just felt like evil, Satanists, bad things. And so again, I was like, you know what? It's not my movie. And it's a pro-Christian anthem with a bunch of oogie things I don't like in it, but I couldn't really pin them down on anything. And I was thinking, gosh, again, I'm just going to have to say, you know what? Let's just stop watching these. Like, I'm done. I'm like over the super conservative Christian thing. And I don't want to live in their world. And I'm just like, I'm sick of everything they do and say, and all of their stupid songs. And I'm just tired of it. All that to say though, that I was looking strictly at the Satanists, and you pulled out some stuff that I'll call subtle just because I didn't catch it, but I think it was there. And I think that actually warrants some downgrading. I still don't know how far down I can take it. I don't think I can take it to an F because it mostly just called bad, bad. Not entirely. I think that some of that sexuality stuff is really fascinating, actually, that you've found. And I do think it was there. I don't know. And I don't like it. I don't like it. I'm not saying I like it, but I'm saying that I think tolerance has to hurt. And I think I need to like model that, especially when critiquing a culture that I feel does not exhibit that trait properly.
Tolerance has to hurt. I like it. So new liberal slogan along with defund the police. Americans will surely go for it. Laura, I've never ceased to be amazed at your depth of empathy and thought with these things. And I applaud you for that. I give you a hard time about it sometimes because I am who I am. It really is something special, and I recognize what you're saying, and I did not give as much thought to that. I don't know exactly why, but I think I understand what you're saying. And it reminds me of, I wish I knew this. I think this was actually Jon Stewart some long time ago on his show at some point. He said something, this was in the era of Bush. He said something to the to a similar effect about emphasizing that tolerance is tolerance. It is not any sort of appreciation or even respect. It is just like you are saying here, like if you're tolerating somebody, you're not a fan, you're tolerating them, but it is important to tolerate them. And I hear you saying a similar thing here as applied to, or as manifested or brought into being as it relates to the text of a film. I think and this is all about Conjuring 2 still. I'm going to constrain or bracket my comments to that for the moment. I'm inclined to give you, or I'm inclined to recognize, that's not how I want to start that sentence. I think your argument has more applicability and validity with The Conjuring 2, because I, as pro-Christian as it is, and as much as I think there's implicit demonization, pun intended, of, like you said, the demonization of like a poor single mother, it's not egregious and it is implicit. I mean, I obviously have other issues with the film, but for me, I think the much more significant violation of the second film is, which is like my new favorite expression now, is this religious vigilantism. Is this, if you believe in whatever it is, some sort of something as being evil, you are entitled and it is your obligation to your faith or God or whatever the fuck you think to ignore the, not just the empirical world, but even the bureaucracy of the church. And I think in an era, and I think in our modern era, where we mentioned this in our last episode, right, where we have a neo-evangelical fascist movement in much of the world, but in the United States in particular, that is disregarding even the what I would call the progressive elements of the church, a film that provides a rationale and an encouragement of that sort of approach to the world, I think is terribly dangerous and toxic, regardless of whether it's implicit or explicit or whatever. And so I would probably fail it on that alone.
Are you specifically talking about the breaking from the church piece? Like vigilantism is not, as in not respecting the bureaucracy of the religion, because unless you want to place that contextually right now, and particularly like commentary on the current Pope and things that I think do feel progressive about at least that religious institution, I would argue that breaking from religious institution in some sort of vigilante kind of, hey, if this doesn't feel right to you, you don't have to follow it, kind of way, probably has done as much good as the not good that you're referencing, historically speaking. So I don't know if I'm willing to go with you on that. I think anti-empiricism in general is a problem. It's also hard to get away from if you're talking about a film that's about, you know, mythology, essentially. So I think it's tougher than you're making it out to be.
So at base, or at a abstract level, absolutely, I think you're right. And I think that's still where we're sort of, we're not disagreeing, but we're, whatever we're doing, where we're at in conversation here is, I am specifically talking in the context of the US and in the context of, it's breaking from the church towards a fascist cruelty. And it's always breaking from the church towards a fascist cruelty. It's not ever breaking from the church towards compassion or empathy or progress. And so at an abstract level, breaking from the church should be, for me, especially as an atheist, should always be good. Get rid of it. Be spiritual. Don't get involved. But what I have seen, and as much as I follow this, I follow the news fairly closely, but I don't necessarily follow what exactly is going on with the papacy. We've got the Pope has said something about at least birth control being acceptable. That is not the case with the evangelical leaders of the United States. They have doubled down on demonizing birth control, abortion, even in the cases of rape and incest. They just did this condemnation of Biden and said he should not be able to take mass because whatever. They don't break when the church says you shouldn't.
For supporting abortion.
Right. For tolerating abortion. He's no fan of abortion. He's tolerating abortion. Wish he was a fan. Anyway, they didn't, when the Pope and the Christian church said, hey, you probably shouldn't be locking kids in cages and separating families at the border. That's a human rights disaster and a moral and a religious, I don't know, whatever atrocity. I don't know if the church actually condemned that, but I feel like I thought they heard they did at some point. It was, oh no, we're evangelicals in the United States. We need to do that. We know better than the church. It's never, oh, the church is still sheltering and avoiding dealing with their responsibility in the largest pedophile ring in the history of the United States or in the history of humanity. That's not where they're like, oh no, we're going to break from the church and we're going to institute within the United States a system by which we track and hold priests responsible. It's always breaking from the church so that they can be somehow more cruel, more conservative, more racist, more homophobic, more queerphobic. As far as I know, the Pope has also come out and said something towards the direction of like love is love, same gender, whatever, it doesn't matter. Again, so it's not breaking from the church in ways that are in practice, not in the abstract, in practice. What I see the evangelical movement of the United States that is connected to the fascist politics of the Republican Party is specifically, we will break from the church if the church says anything that actually contradicts our shift towards cruelty and fascism. There's never a break from the church towards the other direction. So breaking from the church generally is, I think, or it's some sort of abstract, but I don't think right now in this historical moment, you can take that out of context.
I'm not sure if I agree. I mean, I agree with what you're saying about the evangelical Christian movement and the direction that they break from the church. I'm tempted to throw out some counterexamples, not within that movement, but just saying that, you know, I'm breaking from the church in terms of views on homosexuality and who's allowed to be members of church or, you know, have authority within the church. Like there have been people and institutions who have broken from the wider church to support that. And so that's,
we call something those people Lutherans.
To be, well, but
I'm totally kidding. I just, when am I ever going to get to make another Lutheran joke? I'm sorry, Laura. I'm sorry to derail your serious point.
So I think there are instances of institutions and people breaking from the church in ways that are actually compassionate and are not necessarily problematic. Not the movement that you're talking about, but I think broadly. And I also, if you tie that to what's going on in the church in this film, they're breaking from the church because the bureaucracy hasn't moved the paperwork along fast enough. And so they're going to go forward with the exorcism themselves. What was the break?
In The Conjuring 2, the issue was the church couldn't extend its approval without, basically they couldn't risk their reputation until it was an absolute certainty that this was actually, that there was a possession and an exorcism was required. So it was like, we can't sign off on it and risk looking silly, I guess, was the deal.
So I don't know. I'm going to hold out there that because their concern is their face and because Ed and Lorraine are in this context where they can see what's going on and it's not like the church was like, hey, it's irresponsible to convince people that this is a thing that's truly happening because that could cause a lot of ripple effects in society and that could be really problematic. So you need to hold back. and Ed and Lorraine are like, no, let's just, we saw one thing be weird. We're going to put this all over the newspaper and spread it out there. That would be different. That would be like a really strong instance of the film breaking from the church in a way where the church might actually be trying to make some sort of positive movement. I don't know. I think that connection is too weak to super downgrade it, at least from my opinion. I'm not saying I don't see the argument you're putting out there.
Okay. That's fair. I think you're totally fair in doing that. I think we're back to our human smoke, our fundamental divide about, really, I think the fundamental divide that we're at is we've talked about Popper's paradox of tolerance. Okay. I swear we talked about this. I've been on this for some time. So the paradox of tolerance states that if a society is tolerant without limit, its ability to be tolerant is eventually seized or destroyed by the intolerant. Karl Popper described it as the seemingly paradoxical idea that in order to maintain a tolerant society, the society must be intolerant of intolerance.
Oh, I love that. Oh, I've never heard that. And I love that, Marshall. I love that.
So what
I'm so
you
glad
and
you
I
brought that up.
Oh yeah, it's I've been obsessed with it. I can't believe I haven't said it to you, Laura. I've been like, you know, people meditate on cones, like the Zen riddles, the tree in the forest and all that. I think about this paradox. I feel like constantly since I read it, which is probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. But I think what you and I are discussing here is where we individually would draw the lines of what intolerance do we need to be intolerant of. And you, of course, being the compassionate, empathetic soul that you are, have a greater tolerance for intolerance. And I don't know if anybody listening has any idea what we're talking about at this point, because I feel like I've said tolerant or intolerant 20 times in the last 2 minutes. But I am saying you need to cut that intolerance off at the knees, given the fascist progression in the United States. And you're saying, let's get the fascist a little bit more chest.
That was
totally a dramatic overstatement.
I know. I'm sorry. I know it was, but I just want to, as long as we're digging deep into this, I just want to say, I think it's from my perspective, a difference in what we're labeling as intolerance. Mm-hmm. Not so much because I would not agree with giving intolerance a pass, but I think some of these things are things where I'm willing to say, I don't see that particular thing as necessarily tied to intolerance, even though it's associated, even though it's like in the same cultural box, right? It's all thrown in the big stereotype that I don't like with some things that are really awful, but I'm like parsing through that box and pulling certain things out and saying, well, this by itself, I don't feel like I can necessarily call intolerant, even though that piece definitely is. And they're often sitting right next to each other. but if I don't want to engage in stereotyping in a way, like I said, that I criticize other people for doing. That said, I think, in rough form, what you laid out there is right.
So what you said just really, that made sense to me. And I will need to think on that. Yeah, I think you just got me to a what would change my mind moment of with the second film, still on the second film here. I think you're right. I think I may have filled in some pieces that are highly correlated, but may not be actually in the text of the film itself. However, so I grant you that. I think you've got a phenomenal point there. I think I still don't know if that would change my grade on it, but I think your reasoning there and the clarification there that it's a matter of what counts, not degree, I think is right. I think you're right about that. I think I was misunderstanding that. With this, I feel like there is a stigmatization of, like I said, particularly anything gender, sexuality, that's not hegemonic, heterosexual, hegemonic gender, traditional gender norms, as most folks would call it. And I do want to at least mention, and we got to at least mention that what they are doing in this film is they are digging up and providing a narrative, fictional, but if, I mean, the whole thing of the Warrens is it's based on a true story, right? And the film is providing this narrative that basically says that all the Satan hunters in the early 80s were justified. They were right. And I mean, I've got Satan's Silence right here, which is, and it's been, I mean, this came out 20 years ago. It's been extensively documented since then that the hunting of the Satanists and this whole moral panic in the United States around these satanic cults in the 80s and the 80s through the 90s was absolutely a false witch hunt. And the witch hunt, so to speak, so this book, I'm sorry, I held that up. This is an audio podcast. So the book is Satan's Silence, Ritual Abuse and the Making of a Modern American Witch Hunt by Debbie Nathan and Michael Snedeker. It was the hunting of the supposed Satanists that did radical damage, all kinds of communities. It produced hundreds of false confessions of abuse that destroyed the lives of the kids who ended up confessing about abuse that never happened to them at the coaching of all of these fanatic people who were intent on demonstrating that there were these satanic cults. It destroyed the lives of the kids because they ended up making these false conventions that sent parents and educators and child caregivers to jail, stigmatized them, ostracized them, ruined their lives, labeled them as child abusers when they had done nothing wrong. There's Behind the Bastards does a couple of really great episodes on this. So that history of all these people had this, all these religious evangelical Christian folks had these, not all, but in part or mostly these ideas that there were these satanic cults that were abusing kids, that this is a mythology that has been repackaged and formatted into QAnon. This is the roots of that, which I don't think can be ignored in 2021 when you're releasing this film as well. Those roots are the same roots of kids are being abused by liberals who are Satanists because they aren't church-going, good Christian folks. And we need to hunt those people down, target them, and punish them. Even when none of that is actually based in any kind of reality. Which is not based in any kind of reality with QAnon, and it wasn't based in any kind of reality in the 80s and early 90s when that shit was happening too. And so to provide a film where you're saying, oh, well, that was what was happening. Look, there were satanic cults. This is what was happening. They were casting hexes on kids and coupled with the homophobic and transphobic messages, subtext of the other characters and the shit in the film. This film is not The Conjuring 2. It is very much doing damage of, oh no, you should be out there hunting down the Satanists who don't exist, but never mind that, you should be finding them out and you should be taking it to the courts. If you need to kill them yourself, kill them yourself. And then you can go to the court and the court should listen to you when you plead the devil made me do it defense, or rather I was saving the kid from the devil or saving whoever from the devil. And that's what made me do it defense, which is probably really where they're going with it. So this film, even I grant you completely, I think you're absolutely right about two, but I think that, and I'm not just doing this as reaction defensive of being wrong about that. That's fine, Laura. I can be wrong. I appreciate when you get me on these things and push me to think more deeply as you do. This is not me just kind of trying to, oh, I lost that point, I get this point back. That's not what I'm doing here. I think this film, in stark contrast to the point that you are making that is totally legit about Conjuring 2, this film is not that film. This film is actively doing damage in who it's stigmatizing and how it's justifying and what it is trying to justify or what it is providing justification for how to react to those folks or that situation.
I agree with you on that. And that's why I was so interested in the argument that you were making throughout the first part of this podcast. And also why I said, you know, I went into this third film so immersed in that thought process I had around the second that I think I missed a lot of these things you were pulling out. And so, yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I won't argue with that at all. I think my mindset, which I was starting to feel very sort of happy with myself about around tolerance and all of that.
It's great. You should be tolerant, Laura. I applaud you. Go ahead.
I think it impacted both my emotional state heading into this podcast and also the fact that because I wasn't riled up the way I was with the second one, I do think I missed a lot of these important points, and I appreciate you laying out there what you have. I also think the piece about the legal institution is really important in this film. I mean, that I didn't miss, but I wasn't giving it as much weight in my assessment of the film as I think the argument that you laid out was. And I think you're right, actually, about that. I feel like we can concur in a very comfortable way.
Yeah, yeah.
At the end of this conversation. Like, yeah, I really appreciate the things that you highlighted and pointed out about Free, because I wouldn't have come into this conversation with those pieces at all. And I think they're very important.
Well, I missed like everything with, I think, both the first two Conjuring films. For sure, the first Conjuring film, or I don't know which one it was, but yeah, I think it was the first Conjuring film. So this is why we do these things together, Laura, and why this is so great. Joel Best is the sociologist who talks about satanic panic. That's the name I was trying to think about, or I was trying to come up with. And Best has a couple of articles and also has an edited volume called The Satanism Scare. That's Richardson, Best, and Bromley. That looks actually great. Was reissued in 2017, which is kind of cool. That is very much about exactly what we're talking about, which was this moral panic around satanic cults and saving kids and whatever that all turned into. So does that mean we can also comfortably concur on failing this film?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. I mean, we did that backwards. I'll just say it for those listening. We kind of got ahead of ourselves because the way this all shook out. But the last part of our podcast is we step back and take an overview of the pieces that we've discussed throughout the episode and come to a conclusion on what the overall grade should be in terms of the film's contributions to empathetic, sociologically informed understanding of the human condition. That might be exaggerated a little bit. It might not.
Yeah, I like that. And I feel so much better failing this one, having sort of come to terms with myself about the second. And I think on the second one, I would probably settle somewhere in the D range. I think on the Christianity front, I want to float it at a C and call it not good or bad on the strictly Christianity front, which was a large chunk of the film. I mean, that takes up 80% of the film's bandwidth, 85. The other stuff was problematic. I'm not saying it wasn't. Like, the gender stuff was bad. The anti-empiricism was bad. Like, but I'm not going to take it down so far based on just that. So I think if I drop that to say a D for those reasons, not for the Christian reasons, then yeah, I feel solid failing this one for all of those reasons, really, that you laid out there that are also not... not directly tied to the Christian message of the film, just happened to be sitting right next to it.
So if we were to want to write a fourth Conjuring film, if we take the first three films as scientific method, media, you know, fourth pillar of democracy, media, that's a little bit of a reach, but that's okay. And this one is criminal justice. What are the other pillars of liberal democracy that we could attach? We could have the Warrens disabuse us of our belief in the tenets of liberal democracy.
I was going to say, we got to go straight for democracy, right? Like, democratic participation and political participation and the political process. The legal system's different from the political process. I think there's room to take that down.
So would we have a politician's kid get? We're gonna have like one of the squad, their kid is is possessed.
I don't know.
Or how would
yeah, how do we pull in like the meaninglessness of voting also? I feel like that would have to be part of it. You know, the anti-empiricism around the voting process would have to make its way in there.
You could have like someone running for office is bewitching, has been has invited in a demon to be able to win the election and is using their mystical powers to like win over voters. And so the Warrens have to go in and reveal that their opponent running against them is the good Christian family person who actually is
something. There's something there. Something. It's something about only those votes count and the other ones don't. And we have to adjust the tally to reflect the moral superiority of one candidate. There's something there for sure.
Okay. We're not in the practice of predictions here. I just wanted to get something on the record in case they do a Conjuring 4. If there's something that comes up, we'll have to see.
I think we should wrap it.
Intro? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was just having too much fun.
I'm having a ton of fun actually, but only because I still have to pack for my trip and stuff. So.
Oh yeah.
I think it's time to call it.
All of our episodes, past episodes, are available for free. Our website is collectivenightmares.com. If you can't find our episodes on Spotify or iTunes, they're all there. We love it if you go back and listen to the ones that sound interesting to you. We're also on Instagram at Collective Nightmares. You can look there for new episodes. So we'd love it if you'd subscribe. That way they'll pop up when we get them done. I have been less consistent with that because other things going on with me, but the episodes are coming. So we appreciate you sticking with us. And if you are so inclined as to rate us or review us or tell someone you know who you think might enjoy hearing us discuss, we would love it if you would do that also. We appreciate you listening. We hope you stuck. If you stuck through the whole long haul, we hope there was enough framework there for you to follow with us. Horror films are our collective nightmares. I don't want the new version of this page, IMDb. I want one that's actually functional. All right, Wikipedia it is. That's so sad. Let's see here. I need a synopsis. Oh, fine. God bless America. Welcome this. Oh, shoot. I'm sorry. I'm going to wrap up the actual episode. Hold my purse, Laura. We're going to have a discussion.
I love it.
I don't know.
I love it. I love it.
We are the podcasters who are going to expose the disciples of the Ram cult.
I like hold my purse. I think it's great.
You like hold my purse? You just say that because you're tired?
No, I like it.
Okay. All right. Enjoy Ohio. Send me a text or something when you do something terrible.
Awesome.
I'll enjoy that.
Thank you for understanding.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll let you go.
Okay.
Enjoy. Thanks for fitting this in, Laura. Sorry about the miscommunication again.
No, it's okay. I'm glad we did it. This was super fun. And now I feel like I learned something. In watching the film, I didn't learn a lot, but I learned a lot from our podcast. So I'm so glad we did it.
This was good. Okay. All right.
I'll talk to you soon. Bye. I feel settled. Mostly ready. Still have to pack tonight, but it's no big deal.
Okay. Pack for Ohio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Ohio's been the news. You've seen Ohio's been in the news for the two headlines I've seen in Ohio are the small town sheriff who put a KKK robe on the black police officer's desk and probably got fired. Hilarious. He did it as a joke. And the governor is arguing that doctors and such should be able to deny health care to LGBTQ folks because of their sexuality.
Really?
So yeah, Ohio's keeping it real.
Wow, I didn't hear that. The last Ohio story I saw was something about some guy who was running for I don't know, some sketchy sounding guy who was running for some political office. But wow, I didn't hear that. When did that happen with the doctors?
I don't know. I can send it to you. You can chat amongst your friends, right?
Yeah, right.
Stop, share screen, optimize for video. Okay. I wish I could just leave that on as default. And who's the sociologist? Dang it. Hold on, give me just 1 second. Documents. Shoot. I can't. Dang it. What is their name? Oh, God. Anyway. Sorry.